This week on The Score, how disruptive will a construction project on Route 29 be? Can the University of Virginia overcome its sordid history of promoting eugenics? Is there a free trade agreement in Britain's post-Brexit future? What's in store for summer theater patrons this year? All this and more on The Score, so don't go away.
You're listening to The Score from Bering Drift with your host, Rick Sincere.
Welcome back to The Score from Bering Drift. I'm your host, Rick Sincere. Traffic is like the weather. Everybody complains about it, but it seems nobody does anything about it. This summer, the Virginia Department of Transportation is trying to fix a traffic safety hazard in Fauquier County, where U.S. Route 29 intersects with Vint Hill Road. I attended a town hall meeting last Tuesday at Battlefield Baptist Church near Warrenton, where I asked VDOT spokesman Lou Hatter about that project and what alternatives exist for drivers traveling from central Virginia to northern Virginia during construction disruptions. Lou Hatter with VDOT. We had a town hall meeting here tonight about the planned construction at Vint Hill Road and Route 29. What motivated this big construction project?
This location, Route 29 at the Vint Hill Road intersection, is the number one area in the Culpeper District in terms of need for safety improvements. We have a significant crash history there. In the 5 years between 2013 and 2017, we had 113 crashes, many of which were in the northbound lanes. We have a series of hills on that approach to the intersection. So traffic coming northbound, doing highway speed, comes up onto those hills, and traffic, when the signal is red, traffic that's waiting for the light gets down into that dip area between the hills. You can't see it. Coming northbound, people pop over the crest of that hill, and they're right on top of the traffic sitting there for the signal. And a large percentage of those crashes that we have had in this area are rear-end crashes caused by people running up onto traffic that they can't see.
And the construction of this will include the destruction of the hills, the
blowing
it up. How will that work?
Well, essentially what we're going to do is regrade that northbound approach to improve the site distance, get rid of those hills, essentially. So our contractor is going to come in there. They will, and let me back up a little bit, a little history here. The northbound lanes are the original Route 29 lanes. And back when they were built, there was less of a ability to deal with solid rock in highway construction. So typically, they did what they could to alleviate those hills, and then they just went with it, because you're also talking about a time when there was much less traffic out here. The travel speeds were much slower, and so we have this northbound lanes where we have these hills.
Mm-hmm.
So our contractor is going to come in. They will drill down through the asphalt, place charges, and blast the rock out, and then remove it.
And what's happening to the debris? Where is that going?
The debris will be hauled off-site. There's a commercial site just northwest of the Vint Hill Road intersection where they are doing some development on that site, and the contractor has reached a private agreement with that landowner to dump the rock on that site.
So, and that reduces the costs for the Commonwealth.
it does reduce the cost significantly. One of the things that the contractor described, they're a large corporation, and they have sister companies, one of which is Cedar Mountain Stone down in quarry down in Culpeper County. So they are planning to bring out their quarry equipment to do this work. They have a lot of experience with dealing with rock. They have a subcontractor who's very experienced with blasting, and they will bring out this large quarry equipment that can haul several dump loads worth of rock at one time. And because they're able to dispose of it so close to the work site, they're able to use these long, large hauling trucks as opposed to regular dump trucks.
I think the most important questions for our listeners are, one, what's the timetable for this project?
The contractor started on June 3rd. They started working at night. They're doing single lane closures, both northbound and southbound. They'll be working Sunday night through Thursday night all the way up until the week of July 4th. They won't be working over the Independence holiday weekend. At noon on Monday, July 8th, they will shut down both northbound lanes of Route 29 just north of Riley Road, Route 676. Mm-hmm. And that will remain closed until August 2nd. So through that time, we'll have a complete closure of Route 29 northbound. Southbound lanes will not be affected. The Route 215 Vent Hill Road intersection will still function. Traffic on 215 will be able to turn left to go south on 29. They'll be able to turn right to go north on 29. Southbound traffic on 29 will still be able to turn left onto Vent Hill Road. But obviously, the northbound leg of that intersection will no longer function.
And the total project is going to last until about September 30th?
Yes. Once the lanes are reopened on August 2nd, they will still have some additional work to do to finish things up, essentially the kind of the dress-up work. That will be mostly outside the lanes. They will still be allowed to do nighttime lane closures, but it will only be during the nighttime like they're doing now.
Okay. And what about alternative routes? Suppose somebody is driving from Culpeper or Point South and they're heading to Fairfax or Arlington County. What roads do they need to take?
They need to take Route 17 on the north end of Warrenton, where 15, 29, and 17 split. They should take Route 17 north toward Marshall, get on Interstate 66 at Marshall, and then head east from there. People look at it and go, wow, that's way out of the way. But remember, there's going to be a lot of congestion in the area. We've got a good four-lane road on Route 17. Of course, you have an Interstate 66, interstate quality highway with multiple lanes. So we really feel like the best route for people to take is going to be that 17 to 66. That's going to be the regional detour route.
What's the estimate of the additional time it would take to drive to the D.C. area?
What we are suggesting for people, now remember the biggest impact is going to be in the morning because it's the northbound lanes that are being closed. We understand this is going to be a huge inconvenience for people. There is no question about that. We're not going to sugarcoat that at all. We recognize that it's going to cause delays and congestion. So what we're saying is plan an additional 30 minutes for your trip, particularly during the morning. If it doesn't take that long, maybe there's time for a cup of coffee. But we would rather have people arrive early than arrive late. And we also anticipate in past projects, the Culpeper District has some experience with this kind of projects. Several years ago, we did a major intersection reconstruction down just north of Charlottesville, where we shut down most of Route 29 over the summer. This was a multi-month mm-hmm. closure. And what we found was the first few days were really difficult because no matter how much you get the word out, people haven't heard it. They're not sure what to do. But after the first few days, people kind of figured it out, and particularly for the local folks, they know their way around using mm-hmm. alternative routes. What we're really concerned about and what we're really trying to get the word out to the most is people who are not from this area, who may be traveling through, headed to D.C. for vacation, or from another area of Virginia, people who have work to do, commercial traffic. Those are the people who we really want to make sure they understand they really need to get off at Warrenton, take 17 north toward Marshall, get on 66 and head east from there.
And when people are coming back south, do they need to take that same route or can they use a different route?
There should not be that same level of congestion on southbound because the southbound lanes are the the only time the southbound traffic will be affected is during the day when the blaster is doing a shot. At that point, southbound traffic will be stopped at the Vent Hill Road intersection for up to 8 minutes while they actually do the blast and then check to make sure everything's clear. Then traffic will be released to go southbound. But otherwise, both lanes of 29 southbound will be open, with the exception of those nighttime closures that we already talked about. But that's single lane closures, not the entire roadway closed.
Two additional questions. What's the total cost of this project? What are we paying for it?
The contract is about $3.5 million. The total cost of the contract is $4.6 million.
Yeah, that seems rather cheap considering the kind of work they're doing.
Well, that's the key to why we were able to do it, because typically if you try to do a project like this, what we call under traffic, in other words, with traffic still moving mm-hmm. through, the maintenance of traffic cost is a significant number. So by eliminating the need to try and move traffic through the project while the work is going on, we were able to not only compress the schedule significantly, but also reduce the cost significantly as well.
And finally, are there any other major projects within the Culpeper District or nearby that people should know about that could affect their travel during the summer?
That's a really good question. On the south end of Warrenton, we are replacing a grade separated intersection there at 1529 and Broadview Avenue, which is Business 29. We're replacing that signal controlled intersection with a grade separated interchange. That work is mainly being done outside the travel lanes right now. So there's shoulder closures and a lot of equipment and a lot of activity going on, but it doesn't really affect traffic for the most part. Again, lane closures are being done at night on that project as well.
Well, Lou Hatter, thank you for the answering these questions. For people like me who travel up and down 29 at least once a week from Charlottesville to D.C., these are important questions to have answered.
Well, we really believe that the most important thing that we can do is let the public know what we're doing. People who have the information they need, they can make informed choices. And that's our job, is to really try and make sure that people know as much as possible beforehand. One other thing I might mention is, to the extent possible, people may want to consider, being that it's summer, if they have the opportunity to do some teleworking, or some jobs allow people to flex time where they might start or end their day a little bit different hours so that their travel would be kind of off peak. That may be something to consider if people, not everybody can do that, of course, but mm-hmm. to the extent that people are able to do that, that might be a consideration to do. We're just trying to throw out ideas, anything that might help people to minimize the inconvenience.
Well, thank you for joining us on the Score from Bering Drift. I appreciate your time, and I hope that you'll inform us about other projects in the future.
Be happy to.
The Score is produced by Bering Drift, Virginia's top site for news and politics. To learn more, visit beringdrift.com.
Since the mid-1970s, the Heritage Theater Festival has brought professional productions of plays and musicals to Charlottesville in cooperation with the University of Virginia. This year, the Summerstock Company will present a rock and roll musical, a new take on a classic novel, a beloved three-hanky comedy, and a new play about human values. I spoke with Artistic Director Jenny Wales about the Theater Festival's upcoming summer season.
We're here with Jenny Wales, who's the Artistic Director of the Heritage Theater Festival at the University of Virginia. For some of our listeners who don't know what the Heritage Theater Festival is, can you explain it?
Yeah, absolutely. So the Heritage Theater Festival is the professional theater at the University of Virginia. And every year we bring in professionals from around the country, directors, designers, actors, and technicians, to intersect with our faculty, students, staff, alumni, and community members.
And that actually segues into the next question I was going to ask. How does the UVA Department of Drama benefit from the Heritage Theater Festival and vice versa?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think one of my favorite things about Heritage is that it really provides a cyclical idea of mentorship, so that our early career professionals are learning from our professionals and our professionals are learning from our early career professionals. And I think that's what we try to do in the drama department. I also teach during the academic year. And I think that that's really center to our work is that constant exchange of information and that collaborative nature of theater as an art form. And so I think it's a very symbiotic relationship between Heritage and the department, and we all continue to learn and grow together.
And theater is very much collaborative. How many people are involved in the productions this summer?
So this summer, there's 120 of us, and that's including all of the actors, all of the technicians, directors, designers, staff, everyone. So we aren't all here at the exact same time. We roll on and off depending on our contracts. But yes, about 120 total.
And yeah. Tell me about the shows. What are you producing this year?
So this summer we're producing, we open with Million Dollar Quartet, which is a rock and roll musical about a real life event in 1956 when it just so happened that Carl Perkins, Jerry Lee Lewis, Elvis Presley, and Johnny Cash were all at Sam Phillips' Sun Studios in Memphis. And it dramatizes that evening, and it really gives us some insight into who they were as humans and also some incredible music. Yeah, yeah.
And what's the second show?
So the second show is Pride and Prejudice, which is an inventive new adaptation of Jane Austen's kind of epic, classic, sweeping story. And Kate Hamill, who adapted it, has compressed it down to 8 characters, and they double and triple, and then and it's just it's tons of fun. It's really, really funny and kind of raucous and takes what we think about Austen and kind of turns it on its head.
Is it set in the 19th century or is it modern dress?
It's set in the 19th century, and it is it's costumed in the 19th mm-hmm. century, and yet there is a modern sensibility to mm-hmm. it. So I think it's a really interesting thing for patrons to see that idea, because it is influenced by where we are now as well. So there's, but it still has all of the, you know, what we know to be Austen. And then we go, we're producing Steel Magnolias, which is a, of course, a beloved film, but it's a play first and an extraordinary tale of friendship. And so I'm really excited about that one as well. And then
Steel Magnolias, the film is celebrating mm-hmm. its 30th anniversary. But that means there are a lot of people who have never seen it. So what's it about?
That's true. Yeah, it's about a group of 6 women who are in a beauty salon, and there's something kind of singular that happens when women are together in a beauty salon that close to one another, and they're friends who navigate some heartbreak and heartache and loss together. But they do it through laughter, which I think is a really incredible thing about this piece, is that it really leads with laughter, even through the sadness of the piece as well.
And you've got a local beauty salon that is teaching your actors how to be hairstylists.
We do. We do. The Hair Affair in Charlottesville is actually teaching us how to manipulate hair and do the things that are called for within the show. So we're incredibly grateful to have their support. Yeah.
And what's your fourth show of the season?
So the fourth show of the season is a new play called The Niceties by Eleanor Burgess. And it's an incisive play that deals with race and power in academia. I think it really is dealing with how are we speaking to one another right now? Are we listening? Are we not listening? And what happens if we're not actually hearing one another and having conversations that are difficult? And that show will actually be, it's an evening in 2 parts. So the first part is the performance, and the second part is a community conversation where we will talk about the issues of the play with community leaders, activists, students, etc. So I'm really looking forward to that engagement with our community for that piece.
Is that a two-hander, or does it have more than 2 characters?
It's a two-hander, mm-hmm. yeah.
So that's an interesting way to...
It's a professor and a student.
Now, yeah. are you using all of the performance spaces within the Culberth Building for this season?
So we're not. So we're using, for the performances, we're using the Culberth, which is the mm-hmm. proscenium space, mm-hmm. and then we're using the Kaplan, the Ruth Kaplan Theater, which is the thrust space. The Helms Theater, which is more of the black box that people may know, we're actually using that for rehearsal space because we have so many shows rehearsing simultaneously or overlapping. We don't have enough rehearsal space in the building. And they're building the set in the theaters. So it's a little bit of Tetris trying to figure out what rooms people will be in at what times. So we use the Helms as a rehearsal space and then event space for some events.
Just one last quick question. Where can people find out more about the Heritage Theater Festival, and where can they buy tickets?
Sure. So the easiest thing to do is to go to the website, and that's heritagetheaterfestival.org. And that has all of the information, that has updated box office hours if you want to come in to 109 Colberth Road and purchase your tickets at the box office or give a call. It has all of that information there at heritagetheaterfestival.org.
And what are the dates of the festival?
So we open on July, well, our first preview for Million Dollar Quartet is June 27th. We open on June 28th for Million Dollar Quartet, and we close the niceties on August 11th.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Jenny Wales, Artistic Director of the Heritage Theater Festival. I appreciate your talking with us on The Score from Bering Drift, and I'm looking forward to all the shows this summer.
Well, thank you so much. It's been wonderful to chat with you.
You're listening to The Score from Bering Drift with your host, Rick Sincere.
Foreign policy has been in the news this month, with President Trump traveling overseas to meet foreign leaders and enjoy Queen Elizabeth's hospitality. In a conversation with two young voices, Sam Peek and Rachel Tripp, we talked about immigration, tariffs, Libya, and Trump in Europe. This is an excerpt from a longer chat we had in Arlington, Virginia on June 6th, the 75th anniversary of the D-Day landings at Normandy. We'll hear the rest of this three-way interview next week on The Score.
We're just going to have a sort of a freewheeling discussion about what's going on in the world. And when you think about it, a lot of these immigrants from Latin America, south of Mexico, even living in Mexico is an improvement for what they have. Mexico is a middle-income country, industrializing, and this is one of the problems with the tariffs because, you know, we've got the supply lines between Mexico and the United States and Canada in the automotive industry, for instance, that would be disrupted by adding import taxes to auto parts, for instance.
So this is a comment that I've made on the record before, and it is that particularly when the caravan was moving up from Central America, South America, coming up through the continent, if they were genuinely seeking immediate physical safety or immediate reprieve from an overarching government or oppressive conditions, there were many opportunities for them to stop on their journey and find themselves, as you just mentioned, in a much safer, cleaner environment where they do have an opportunity to prosper. If the United States was their long-term goal, they also would even be an opportunity to find short-term work, find ways to come through the system legally, and by not doing so, they're proving that, at least in my mind, asylum is not their immediate claim, or that personal safety is not their foremost goal. It's really to enter the United States, which I completely respect, but only if they're willing to do so legally.
And if I understand the way asylum is supposed to work in the international system, a refugee is supposed to ask for asylum in the first country that they reach in which they can find safety. Is that right, Sam?
If you have, say, a safe third country agreement with the country, and we do not have that with Mexico because Mexico has not demonstrated that they're not going to comply with the international law of non-refoulement, which means that you turn people away without processing their asylum claim first. We don't have agreement with them, and so that's why they are able to legally claim asylum in the United States. Back to the point about people who are crossing between ports of entry illegally, you can see that the Trump administration has exacerbated that quite a bit. You have the union chief of border patrols claim as such, and you have DHS interviews with people with border patrol agents claiming as such too. It's metering where he's blocking people unnecessarily from entering through the ports legally. And what they're doing is they'll re-enter three times or four times, and then they'll cross through in between ports, and then they get prosecuted as entering illegally.
Is the Trump administration policy of threatening tariffs a way of pushing Mexico to honor some of these international agreements that already exist but they're not participating in, to get a treaty between the United States and Mexico dealing with these issues? I know the Mexican foreign minister was in Washington, I think today, talking to Vice President Pence. Is this something that's on their talking points?
I'm not sure. I know that the problem with this is that if you're going to negotiate something, you have to make sure that you're willing to go through with that. And Trump has even proposed extending the tariff to 25% within the course of time.
Yeah, I think October 1st would be the deadline for raising it to 25%.
And and the United States economy, especially in Rust Belt areas like Michigan, which 10% of their imports rely on Mexican goods. It's going to devastate a lot of those areas.
It's almost as if President Trump is trying to scuttle NAFTA 2.0, the USMCA. Do you think he has something nefarious in mind?
I think that President Trump is someone who prides himself on his ability to act as a businessman, make deals that he believes are profitable, and I think in this instance, make deals that are going to be beneficial in his mind to the United States. I think that he does have the good of the country in mind, not necessarily some underhanded or nefarious agenda, but I do think, again, that the approach to tariffs or trying to force an agreement through tariffs, while also maybe having some of those diplomatic meetings like you just mentioned with Vice President Pence or whoever else, is not necessarily the best way to move forward, since it's not really helping the immigrants in question or the American people.
Let's segue a bit. President Trump is on a diplomatic mission right now. He's overseas for the D-Day ceremonies at a state banquet with Queen Elizabeth in London. How do you assess his visit to the UK, Ireland, and France?
So considering going off of our discussion of diplomacy here, I think that any opportunity for us to have a positive and friendly interaction with our allies is always a good idea, always a positive move for international relations and diplomacy for the United States. Obviously, the United Kingdom, Great Britain, and the United States have always had that special relationship, and I like to see this administration furthering that with the Queen, who obviously has also had her own opportunity to further that relationship with many presidents in the past. From what I've seen, this has been an overall very positive visit for both the United States and the UK, although obviously there have been the typical protests that we would expect when a foreign leader visits any country.
And just as an aside, Queen Elizabeth is 93 years old. I've never seen a more vigorous nonagenarian. I mean, when she speaks with authority and grace, and it's amazing. She's dealt with every president of the United States since Truman. Longer than most of us can ever even hope to live. There was another question I wanted to ask. Seems to be some confusion about U.S. policy towards Libya right now, and you know something about that. What can you tell us?
So I think when it comes to the way that we treat our allies internationally, again, as I just mentioned, it's always very important that we maintain as many diplomatic relations as possible, but we have to put the safety of our own American people first. With the civil war that's happening in Libya, obviously it's awful to see the violence that citizens are dealing with. Civilians are dealing with a very challenging coup, essentially, on a regime that for a long time has been in power. And when we consider whether or not the United States should interact with that war, should get involved, I really think that it's their civil war, it's their problem to deal with, essentially, and I would not like to see our own American troops being sent over into a situation of violence and danger, when really the Libyan regime and the Libyan system of governance is not a threat to us as it stands, or with the potential gaining of power of this new regime as well.
Yeah, there was a specific instance last month, or maybe it was in April, when Secretary of State Mike Pompeo issued a statement in support of the Libyan government, the provisional government, I guess it is, in Tripoli. And a couple days later, President Trump had a phone conversation with a rebel leader, Haftar, and essentially endorsed him. Is there a disconnect in U.S. foreign policy making?
I think that there has been several instances where Pompeo and President Trump may have viewed international relations or issues of foreign affairs differently. I think that we've seen that with the recent potential conflict in Iran as well, where Pompeo is much more willing to involve American troops in that conflict in Iran, and President Trump, I think, has said on the record many times that he wants to have a new approach to the Middle East that does not mirror the one that we've had in the past, which has been very interventionist, very hawkish, and I don't believe that President Trump wants to further that tradition of involving our troops in conflicts that are not necessarily a threat to the United States, a threat to our economy, and certainly not worth endangering our own servicemen and women.
Just to wrap things up, we've been talking about immigration, we've been talking about tariffs, foreign policy in general, but on the immigration issue, I'd like to get each of you to assess whether there will be some kind of, I won't call it comprehensive, but significant legislation dealing with immigration issues between now and the election in November 2020. Sam, do you have any ideas about that?
You know, with Trump, it's unpredictable, but I'm not optimistic that we're going to get the politically polarizing issues like DACA through anytime soon. I think that if we're going to look at immigration reform, we have to see it through smaller parts of overall larger bills, you know, like more legal protections for people who served in the military, immigrants who served in the military, liberalizing health, you know, foreign workers and industries like healthcare. But I don't see an actual immigration reform bill actually passing.
And Rachel, what do you think?
I think that the answer might be a little bit different were we not heading into an election year. I think that this is an issue that the Democrats are certainly going to try to bring to light. They're going to make it a election year issue. But I don't believe, particularly with the gridlock that we've been seeing with this Congress and this administration, that there will be any particularly new or revolutionary legislation passed this year. I would like to see our legislators taking a long, hard look at our immigration system and considering what a best solution is to protect our illegal immigrants, our citizens, and also to ensure that there is a path for, again, law-abiding immigrants to come into this country and contribute to an economy that does rely on their contributions.
Young Voices is a great organization, and I'm glad that you're participating in it. Are either of you working on articles that may be published in the next couple weeks, regardless of what the topic is?
I feel like I'm always working on something. I've been following the Democratic 2020 candidates, and as the news unfolds, so does my writing, recently published on Mayor de Blasio's candidacy announcement in New York City. As an East Coaster, I'll be following all of the news from all of the candidates that are coming from the Northeast region, and I will be sure to keep you updated as that goes on.
And Sam, do you have anything coming up?
Yeah, I'm writing about our need to bring in more foreign healthcare workers to the United States. There's a lot of bills in Congress right now that aren't getting enough coverage, and one is likely to pass, too.
Okay, well, that's an interesting topic, a sort of an immigration issue in miniature, but it affects our whole healthcare system. Well, I'd like to thank you both for joining me today, and welcome to The Score. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Do you have an idea for future episodes of The Score? Write to host Rick Sincere at ricksincere@gmail.com.
Eugenics is a pseudoscience that seeks to justify racism. Physician and medical historian Preston Reynolds recently gave a lecture in which she revealed the sordid record of the University of Virginia, which promoted eugenics from the late 19th century right up into the 1950s. After her presentation, I asked Dr. Reynolds a few questions about her historical research.
A lot of people don't know what eugenics is. How is it defined?
Eugenics is a science of improving people through selective breeding or through selective procreation, trying to get the most fit people to have children with fit people to produce even fitter children, and to prevent in this country those that were considered unfit to not be able to have children with other individuals who were considered unfit.
It's sort of a human version of animal husbandry.
Absolutely. It's a human version of animal husbandry.
Now, you talked in the lecture tonight about UVA's history in the 19th, 20th century of promoting eugenics. We know now eugenics is really bad science. From the context of the 19th century, was it good science?
No.
Even then, it would have been considered bad science?
Well, science is a product of its times. And it's important to understand that scientific investigation is often shaped by the world that those scientists live in.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why we have the experimental method. That's why we have randomized controlled trials. That's why we have various investigators studying the same questions. But are the questions that we ask are shaped by the world in which we live.
Mm-hmm.
And in the 19th century, we were just developing the experimental method. The research tools that the eugenicists used are not considered sound research tools. So the pseudoscience was reinforced by a racialized society that were producing laws that reinforced that context in which the science was emerging. So nobody, so it wasn't really until population genetics emerged and the international outcry against eugenic science that the whole field collapsed in it, you know, within itself. And there really was a public outcry against the eugenics rhetoric.
And, of course, in the early 20th century, eugenics was supported by such prominent people as Theodore Roosevelt and Woodrow Wilson.
And many university presidents.
And that leads me to my next question, which is the legislation that developed out of this in the 1920s. Could you comment on that a bit, especially the Racial Integrity Act and such?
So I see the Racial Integrity Act as an effort by racial zealots, white supremacists, to put the Negro question to bed. And they didn't want to live in a world that was supporting miscegenation, cultural fluidity, the rise and growth of black communities, black businesses, black intellectual development. And in order to suppress that cultural expression and development, that one-drop rule, and forcing African Americans to live behind the veil, secured for them a space that they thought was pure and free of disease risk, and a space where they could develop and flourish, not threatened by people of other cultures and races and people that look different than they did.
One of the most shocking quotations I saw you draw on tonight was, I don't remember who the source was, but essentially said that achievements by black professionals, doctors, lawyers, teachers, was a social menace.
Yeah, that was Paul Berenger.
And he was a prominent leader at UVA.
He was chair of the faculty at the time.
The equivalent of being president.
The equivalent of being president. And the reason why I chose that quote is for people to begin to understand why Charlottesville had such a small, almost minuscule, professional community. There were two doctors, one dentist, a few nurses, a few clergy, and the rest were artisans and laborers.
This was not Harlem.
And this was not Harlem. This was not Black Wall Street, which is Durham. This is not even Richmond. Richmond has a hospital. Norfolk has a hospital. Washington, D.C. has Howard University. So you have even centers close to Charlottesville that have really thriving black professional communities. Look at Hampton with its nursing school and its hospital. You know, it established as one of the first nursing programs for black nurses in the country, with the first baccalaureate for black nurses in the country. So you have, even within Virginia, other centers where African Americans are able to thrive and grow and develop and take care of their people. But in Charlottesville, that is suppressed. That's oppressed because those citizen leaders are creating an environment that they're not allowing that growth to happen and supporting it.
Can you tell me a bit about Walter Plecker and the role he played in racial supremacy, white supremacy?
It's a multifactorial role. I think that he is a lot more important than historians have looked because he has multiple roles, but he has a critical role of being head of vital statistics for the Health Department of Virginia for decades. And he uses that position to administer the Racial Integrity Act through marriage licensing. But he also uses that role to ensure that black children are registered as black children, white children are registered as white children, and that those children who are fair-skinned with blue eyes, who have darker-colored skinned parents, are categorized as black, and so they don't have access then to white schools, white opportunities that they probably had before this was implemented.
Final question I've got is also related to the legislation in the 1920s, which is the sterilization, Buck versus Bell. How does that all fit in?
It's another dimension of the same movement. It was an effort to get rid of defective germ plasma. And it was another mechanism to protect the white gene pool from being weakened with the introduction of genetic material from what were considered less fit individuals.
I thought it was interesting that you said that Virginia's sterilization regime was harsher than in the deeper South because of the role of the Catholic Church, I guess in Louisiana, Alabama,
yeah.
Mississippi.
Yeah. Well, Catholics are against the termination of life.
Mm-hmm.
And so those states that were strongly Catholic never passed sterilization laws.
And Virginia never had a very large, even to today, yeah. never has had a very large Catholic yes. population.
It was more secular than other southern states.
Mm-hmm.
And so it bought into the eugenics rhetoric as a way to modernize and move into the progressive era and become economically more developed.
I guess the greatest irony of all this is that these types of ideas were considered progressive in the early 20th century.
Yeah, it's tragic.
Well, thank you for your comments today, and thank you for the lecture. I'll be sure to link to this from
Thanks.
Our website.
Did you miss the previous episode of The Score? Look for our podcast at bearingdrift.com.
While there is still no certainty that Britain will leave the European Union, Brexit is still on the table. One result may be a bilateral trade agreement between the United States and the UK. I went to the Cato Institute to talk to trade policy analyst Ryan Bourne about the future of American-British trade relations. Here's Ryan Bourne. President Trump has been in the UK and Ireland and France, and one of the topics he's talked about is potential trade relations between the United States and the UK in the event that Brexit happens. What are the prospects for that? Could there be a US-UK free trade agreement along the lines of NAFTA?
Well, at the moment, it's obviously unclear what's happening in relation to Brexit. The Prime Minister has tried to get a withdrawal agreement through Parliament three times and failed on every occasion. We're now set to have a new Prime Minister in the UK in the coming months. And so really there are two potential paths out of the EU from here. There's passing the withdrawal agreement already on the table before October 31st, or the UK leaving the European Union without a deal. Now, one of the major advantages of leaving the European Union is repatriating an independent trade policy. That means Britain would have the ability to sign free trade agreements around the world. The problem at the moment is part of that withdrawal agreement that the EU has offered the UK would contain a provision called a backstop. And that backstop in relation to Northern Ireland would mean that unless the EU agrees with the UK to sort out some other arrangements for that border, the UK might find itself locked in the European Union's customs union, which is the kind of common trade and tariff policy of the EU. So I do think there are prospects for a UK-US trade agreement. Both sides seem to want it. They say they want it. The President's been very open about an open and comprehensive trade agreement with the UK and has bigged that up in this trip. That cannot happen until the UK leaves the EU and the UK supersedes that agreement with the EU on what to do about the Northern Ireland border.
This is another question entirely because President Trump has shown antagonism towards multilateral agreements. If you were to consider a potential US-EU trade agreement to be multilateral, but the EU is really a unit, would a US-UK trade agreement serve as an impediment to a US-EU agreement?
I don't think it would serve as an impediment. Obviously, there were extreme difficulties in getting a US-EU trade agreement through. That was the TTIP that was attempted to be negotiated a few years ago, and progress on that completely stalled. President Trump has shown a willingness to negotiate bilateral deals. He wants to renegotiate existing deals into kind of bilateral deals. So I think in terms of the US and the UK, the prospects for a deal if the UK repatriates that trade policy are quite strong for a number of reasons. First of all, the UK is not a country that is taking US manufacturing jobs, which Donald Trump seems to be very fond of. The UK and the US seem to have fairly balanced trade. There's not massive trade deficits or surpluses on either side, which seems to be something that that occupies the president. And obviously, both countries have pretty strong political defense and strategic relations, and there's a good deal of goodwill and trust between the two. I think one of the more likely impediments to a trade deal between the US and the UK is what the UK decides to do independently in regards to its food standards and agricultural policy. One of the things that the EU really doesn't like about the way the US regulates its internal market is its approach to things like GMOs, GM crops, mm-hmm. And some of the standards around animal welfare, which are different, and they're currently not mutually recognised between the EU and the US. So if the UK were to opt for a more kind of US-style regulatory regime, I think that would make it harder for the UK to then agree a trade deal with the EU, and vice versa.
One of the things I've heard, and you may be able to confirm this, is that there are about a million Americans who work for British-owned firms and about a million Britons who work for American firms. This seems to provide a strong foundation for U.S.-UK trade relations. And could it go up? Could it be affected negatively at all?
Well, I think one of the things that the UK will be looking for in any free trade agreement is, particularly in financial services, an agreement that workers can be transferred between countries even more easily than they are today. The UK obviously has a huge and important financial sector, and one of the other big financial sectors is based in New York, so they'll be looking for that type of arrangement. But you're right, on the face of it, there are huge numbers of workers of firms owned by American and UK companies in each other's country, and that's reflective of a really important investment relationship between the two. There's huge amounts of foreign direct investment undertaken by American companies in the UK, and I believe I'm right in saying, at least it was a couple of years ago, that the UK was the biggest single country in terms of foreign direct investment into the US. That's if you break the European Union countries up into their constituent parts.
And if it's not Britain, it's probably the Netherlands. They seem to be running in tandem first and second place, which one would not expect, because the Netherlands doesn't appear to be as big an economy as, say, France or Germany.
No, it's remarkable how trade relations and trade patterns and investment flows have a degree of path dependence. I imagine that there's good historical reasons for that. The Netherlands, of course, was one of the countries that first undertook the Industrial Revolution, and those trade and investment ties are long run. And
the Dutch system. Founded Wall Street.
Exactly. Yeah.
So suppose Brexit happens, but it's without an agreement, that the very strong Brexit supporters say, we're just going to cut things off. How will that affect the negotiations with the United States over free trade if Britain is just hanging there on its own?
Well, at one level, it will make those negotiations easier, because the UK will then have full repatriation of trade policy, so we'll be able to engage in those negotiations straight away. It might also speed up the process, because in such a scenario, I'd imagine Britain would be keen to cement geopolitical and trade relations elsewhere. It might adversely affect the politics and dynamics of the situation, though, in the sense that I think what you'll see in the UK is a fair degree of resistance to a comprehensive trade deal with the United States, particularly on the left of politics, mainly because of US demands that there'll be to open up agricultural markets, as we've talked about, but also procurement in healthcare as well, and the opening up of the UK's kind of socialized, nationalized healthcare system. So, personally, I'm hoping that the trade deal with the US, even though I think it's important in the longer term, won't be the first deal that the UK signs, because I think there'll be a huge degree of political resistance to it. Now, if the UK, though, does leave the European Union without a deal, I think there'll be a big political demand within the Conservative Party to try and agree a trade deal with the US quickly, because the US is the biggest advanced developed market out there other than the EU, so they'll be keen to develop a UK's trade policy with the US first.
You may or may not know the answer to this question, but the two most significant countries in Western Europe that are not part of the EU are Norway and Switzerland. How are their trade relations with the United States, and how might they be models for the UK after Brexit?
Well, I don't know too much about that, I'm afraid. The Norway is part of the European Economic Area, so it has a close degree of integration into the European Union single market. Both countries operate under the European Free Trade Area, EFTA. So they negotiate trade agreements as a group. I'm not sure, actually. I'd have to check whether EFTA has a free trade agreement with the United States. I'd imagine not.
But certainly
it's something that could be negotiated. And I think if the UK were to find itself in EFTA, in a sort of outer circle in European relations, then the UK being in there would make that type of trade agreement more likely. But I'd have to go away and check. I'm not sure whether that's the case or not.
So EFTA is just about trade, whereas the EU is about regulations and having common policies that go beyond just tariffs and trade. Is that a good assessment?
Yeah, it's a bit more complicated than that, in that, as you say, EFTA is a free trade area comprising the European Union single market, the EEA, which comprises all EU members plus Norway and Iceland. And then EFTA contains all of those countries, as I said, but then with Switzerland as well. So the EEA countries that are non-EU members negotiate their free trade deals alongside Switzerland. But then the European Union members itself, as you say, are party to a lot more regulation on a number of issues unrelated to trade or even domestic economics as well. So, you know, things like fishing and agriculture policy, energy policy, a whole range of labour market regulations that don't apply to single market countries as well. So it's a much broader and deeper relationship.
Yeah, it seems to have multiple layers that, you know, the average American, even somebody who reads the Wall Street Journal every day, is not going to be aware of this stuff.
I think that's right, yeah. It's, you know, let's not beat about the bush. It's proving a lot more difficult as a result of these institutions developing over four decades for Britain to extricate itself. There are huge numbers of moving parts. Whatever form the UK exits the European Union, if Brexit indeed does occur, the UK will leave certain programmes, likely agriculture, fisheries, and a number of other smaller areas. But then the relationship that the UK has with the European Union from there can take very, very different forms. And it's almost a spectrum of different relationships, from being extraordinarily close and still being in all the economic institutions within the European Economic Area, like Norway, being a bit further out but having a high degree of single market access, but then a more independent trade policy and some other domestic controls like Switzerland, or having a third country free trade agreement with the European Union like Canada, or perhaps not even having a free trade agreement with the EU like the United States of America.
Well, Ryan Bourne, this has been very informative. I think we're going to be looking at this for several months at least, if not several years. So I appreciate you joining us on The Score from Bering Drift.
That's all the time we have this week on The Score. Tune in next week for more conversations about trade and immigration and other topics. For all the writers and editors at Bering Drift, I'm Rick Sincere. Be sure to visit our website at beringdrift.com to check out earlier episodes and come back later for more news, reviews, and interviews. Join the conversation in the comments section and feel free to suggest ideas for guests and topics to discuss. We'll be waiting for you.
Do you have an idea for future episodes of The Score? Write to host Rick Sincere at ricksincere@gmail.com. The Score is produced by Bering Drift, Virginia's top site for news and politics. To learn more, visit beringdrift.com.